All right, we're ready to go. Hello, my name is Nick Brummel. I'm going to talk about some work done in conjunction with Fausto Cattaneo, this young gentleman, good-looking fellow over here, and Kelly Klein, who is my graduate student back at the University of Colorado.
You don't see young men.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's all relative. So, this is your chance to get your own back on me for other things during the week. Today what I want to talk about is formation of magnetic structures by velocity shear. So that's going to be related to the concept of flux tubes, it's going to be related to the concept of shear in the tachyd line and creation of magnetic structures and the Omega effect, that sort of stuff. But let's have a quick review of some of this stuff. I mean, you're all very familiar with the stuff, so I need to go over it very much, but we'll just try and motivate the talk a little bit for everyone in the audience. So, picture of the sun in white light. What you see is a structure on the sun in white light is these things that we know now as sunspots, been followed for many years, and that's about all the structure you see. But if you observe these things over a long time, you find all kinds
of... What do you mean? There are zero streaks. They're more popular than spots. I mean, more bright features than dark.
Yes, there's all kinds of features, but these are big and obvious features which people have noted for a long, long time. And if you follow those features over a long, long time, they have certain properties which people found fun and therefore continue to follow them, such as the well-known butterfly diagram. So in other words, these spots or active regions, which a superset of sunspots, appear at certain latitudes and then start to appear at lower latitudes over a cycle which lasts about 11 years. There's other things associated with this. The polarity reverses after 11 years. The same sort of appearance pattern is the same, but after 11 years, the polarity is reversed. And there's all kinds of other things. The tilt of these sunspot regions has a particular law, Joy's law, and there's all kinds of structure embedded in these things. So, for a long time, and ever since these things were first observed, people have been wondering what the heck these things are. The popular conception that has come out is that these dark patches are manifestations of magnetic field. And the simple idea is that there's a strong toroidal magnetic field, in other words, something which goes azimuthally around the sun, and that these are the bubbling up or rising up or patches of strong toroidal magnetic field. So this concept is very familiar to all of you. It's been proposed in various different ways. There's a picture by Parker of arching loops. Another thin flux tube approximation has shown that this kind of thing can actually occur. And of course, we have some of the famous people of this subject around in the audience today. And lots of calculations have been done of this which show that. You can get a lot of that structure back from this type of approximation. So, but where does the magnetic field come from in the first place? To be able to create the strong toroidal magnetic field, where do we get it from? Well, is it a primordial field? Well, very unlikely, since this thing has this pattern of regeneration every 22 years. It seems more likely that this thing is a generation process. In other words, there's some sort of dynamo going on, where you can define a dynamo as a mechanism that converts mechanical energy into magnetic energy in the conducting fluid of the sun, and then sustains these magnetic fields against all the dissipation effects which are happening. So, and in the sun, we can actually maybe distinguish more than one type of dynamo that may be going on. Because if you look at the morphology of these magnetic fields in a slightly different view here, now we're looking at a magnetogram, then you can see there's two basic types of magnetic field can be divided into two categories by its morphology. So the stuff we've been talking about, the active regions, is large stuff, okay? And it's large stuff which has a cyclic pattern of emergence and lives for many rotations time. So active regions can be considered a large-scale effect. This is why I asked Axel his question the other day, because I think of magnetic regions as some sort of manifestation of a large-scale field. And the other stuff you see is basically you say, well, wherever this stuff is not going on, what do I see? Well, I see these small-scale speckled stuff, the salt and pepper that Sasha calls it, and it has very little large-scale organization. It's bipolar, so in other words, it has both signs, and the rate of this emergence is not dependent on the solar cycle. So this doesn't have a sort of cyclic activity associated with it. So this stuff is around always. This stuff has this cyclic emergence on every 11-year sort of cycle. So you can define the type of magnetic activity you see on the sun into these two classes of things. And one is associated with what we think with a large-scale field, and one is associated with This is small scale, obviously it is smaller scale, so it's small scale field. And so that's where this concept of a large scale dynamo and a small scale dynamo comes in. The stuff that Bob was all talking about this morning is talking about whether, you know, how this stuff is created. So there's a small scale dynamo. Whereas the thing that I'm interested in, the stuff we're going to talk about today, is how does this stuff, the large scale active regions, come about? So there's been a lot of work on this. A lot of the concepts I talk about here come from mean field theory. And so we have a simplistic or intuitive idea of how this stuff, or how a cyclic production of large-scale field can occur. And I'm sure you're familiar with it, but let's just go over it just to get the terminology the same. First of all, we think these sunspots lead us to believe that there's a strong toroidal field somewhere. So first of all, how do we create this strong toroidal field? Well, if we have any poloidal field, which is any sort of dipolar-type field, and any sort of differential rotation of the fluid within the solar interior, then we can take that poloidal field, which looks like this sort of thing, and we can drag it out and stretch it in the toroidal direction. So given some poloidal field, just by having differential rotation somewhere in the solar interior, we can create a toroidal field. And this is often referred to the Omberg effect, because this is the symbol they use to parameterize it in mean field theory. So I'm going to refer to this stretching of poloidal field into toroidal field as, in quotes, the Omberg effect a lot, but it's not really the Omberg effect, because that's a linear thing, a mean field thing, blah, blah, blah. But bear in mind, I'm just using that as a loose term to refer to that mechanism. So luckily for us, differential rotation does appear to exist. So if we look at, if we look at observations, so in this case, we're looking into the interior of the sun by helioseismology, so we're listening to the sound which is emanating from the sun and trying to infer something about the structure of the sun by analyzing the frequencies of those sound, or the splitting, the line splittings of those sound, etc. Then we get some sort of idea of what's going on in the interior. And basically what we find is we have a fast equator, a slow pole, and that seems to imprint itself pretty much through the convection zone. Then we have a pretty much solid body, or we believe we have a pretty much solid body rotating core and interior, and a junction of those two things is what was referred to the other day as the tachocline. So there's a thin shear layer between this radially constant sort of regime and a solid body regime. So there's an interface layer, which is a tachocline. And as you can see, the tachocline has a significant amount of shear in latitude and has a large amount of shear in radius. So this would be a great place for doing this stretching of a poloidal field into toroidal field. So it's widely believed, from the fact that this exists, that there's a great deal of radial shear here, and the fact that this is a stable layer, so it's a better way of trying to keep magnetic field down, and some of the thin flux tube ideas also confirm, or many different types of models have confirmed, that you can get some of the sort of laws and the structure of the activity cycle if you put a certain strength of magnetic field out here. So there's a lot of sort of corroborating evidence which says that this would be a good place to have. No, the tachocline is this little tiny thin bit right here where there's a strong degree of shear. And then below that is part of the radiative core. This isn't shown further down here because they can't really infer things very well.
This still has differential rotation below.
This is very, very weak differential rotation in here. If you look at these contours, they're all sort of very, very similar. So the strong, I mean, here it goes from yellow to blue in a very small amount of region. So yellow to blue, whereas most of this stuff is all yellow.
So you have some radial shear right near the equator,
and then a lot up near the poles. There's quite a lot of radial shear everywhere, but there's more up near the poles than there is down here. Yeah. Well, I know it's the opposite sense. I mean, I guess yeah, change of sign.
There's a point where they match.
Yeah, there's a point right here where they're equal. Yeah, turns from large radial shear here, large radial shear here, zero radial shear.
That's where you see the sunspots.
Well, they emerge there. Yeah, I mean, they come out at this sort of latitude here. But there's a question about, well, this is some of the stuff that came out of thin flux tube theory, which you're not sure whether it's going to be actually what's going on or not, whether they emerge this way or whether they emerge this way. Depends on how fast the thing is rotating, its strength of the magnetic field, etc. If they're really strong, they'll go zoop. No, if they're really fast rotation, it'll go zoop. If they're really magnetic, they'll go zoop. So there's a question about how and why they emerge at a specific latitude. Not what we're addressing.
Weak, they go,
yeah, that's what I said. Oh, okay. So yeah, if it's rotating fast, they go that way, parallel to the axis, Taylor's theorem. So we have them in the tachocline. We have to make them rise somehow. There's this magnetic buoyancy is the mechanism for making these things rise. So if there's magnetic field, if it's concentrated magnetic field, then that exerts a magnetic pressure. If you say that this is in pressure equilibrium, that means that the density inside the tube has to go down. That means that this thing is buoyant and it wants to rise. So that's the simple idea of the mechanism, that even if these things are down in the stable layer or in the convection zone, these things are going to rise because they have a density deficit associated with them due to the contribution to the total pressure from magnetic pressure. I think you guys are all familiar with most of this stuff. I'm just setting the scene. So to complete the cycle, what we need is something which, so we've converted poloidal field to toroidal field. Maybe we've got them out, something like that, but somehow we need to regenerate the poloidal field. So the mean field dynamo theory came up with this name, the alpha effect, for that reverse process. And so I'm going to refer to it loosely as the alpha effect. But basically what it involves is in most of the concepts of mean field theories that rotation has to be invoked such that if you bring something up, the Coriolis force acts on it, it twists it. So if something which is purely toroidal rises, twists a little bit, it creates a poloidal component. And that can happen in a number of different ways. You can have lots of little events of this in the convection zone, so lots of little twists, and maybe they all sum over to give a significant poloidal field. Or you can say you can have this large structure which emerges as a sunspot. It's nicely twisted by the time it comes out of the top, and then it breaks down, and then somehow you get that down to the bottom of the convection zone, and that's the thing which returns toroidal field to poloidal field. So all this leads to the fact that we have this vague intuitive idea of this is how a solar cycle for the large scale field, which is what I'm doing, is the thing which we visualize as active regions, how this thing is all created. And it looks something like this little cartoon sketch I've just drawn right here. So we have some mechanism for creating some poloidal field somehow in the first place, probably in the convection zone somewhere. So either by lots of these little events, breakdown of active regions, or breakdown of active regions at the top. So somehow that gets transported down to the tachocline layer. This is not drawn to scale. So, and the tachocline layer has a large degree of shear, both latitudinally and radially. I've just drawn it radially here. That poloidal field gets sheared out into a toroidal field. That toroidal field somehow creates structures, becomes structured. Those structures are magnetically buoyant and therefore want to rise. And they rise, and then one of two things can happen. If they're too weak, then they get recycled, so they get twisted a little bit and then shredded and recycled around this process again. Or if they're strong enough, then maybe they emerge at the top. So this is a very loose, intuitive picture of how this cyclic emergence of active regions could occur. So the thing I want to talk about today, I mean, there's lots of people working on all kinds of different bits of this picture, but the thing I want to talk about today is this little bit right here. Given some poloidal field in the tachocline somehow, or given some poloidal field in a region of velocity shear, then what happens to it? So does it get? Can you create strong toroidal field from some weak background poloidal field just by the action of localized velocity shear? And then what is the subsequent evolution of that? Does it form structures? Does it rise by magnetic buoyancy? Does it do anything interesting? Does it do anything which may associate with this type of picture? Okay? Everybody with me so far? Yes, I know you're all asleep. You're up not saying anything. So here's the concept. What we're trying to do is just examine an omega effect. Okay, be careful using the word omega effect. Okay, but we're trying to examine omega effect. In other words, we're trying to build strong magnetic toroidal field from the interaction of a weak poloidal field with just a localized velocity shear. And then the questions we want to ask are, can we form anything which looks like tubes? Okay, because we're expecting to have tube-like structures in these things. Do we form any sort of structures? Do these structures then rise due to magnetic buoyancy as they're supposed to, as we expect them to? And then what's the subsequent evolution and geometry of these sort of tubes? Do they have any sort of interesting characteristics which look like the sort of things we see? And do they, this is another interesting point, do they relate at all to some of the other flux tube notions we have? There's thin flux tubes, there's fat flux tubes, which people have evolved. And most of them have been thought up in the sense that we have some idea that these things are supposed to be flux tubes. So we'll think what our favorite sort of view of a flux tube is, and then we'll examine what that looks like. So do the things that we get out of this look anything like those? It's an interesting question. And so then ultimately, do they have anything to do with the tachocline and large-scale activity dynamo dynamics? So, well, I don't know whether you need this, but this we're going to do numerical simulations, okay? And they're going to be very simple box calculations, and I'll show you how the model is set up. But just a little bit about the code we're running. It is fully compressible, fully nonlinear. It uses regular viscosities and everything like that. It's a MHD code, basically, as simple as that. periodic boundary conditions. The horizontal, it's a box, stress-free up and lower, constant temperature up, constant heat flux lower. It's based on a polytruck. It's the sort of standard thing that a lot of us have done with convective codes over the years. Magnetic fields are included in this thing as poloidal and toroidal parts. Means are followed separately. And for this calculation, what I've actually done is put no flux upper and lower boundary conditions on the magnetic field. And what I mean by that is that any horizontal field has a d by dz equals zero at the boundary. So if it comes to the boundary, it can't get out, because otherwise I'm going to run my experiments down. So that's kind of what we've been doing these things.
Does that mean if you generate a toroidal field, it'll just pile up at the top?
It can pile up at the top or get recycled, yes. Okay. So, I mean...
But also poloidal field, because you've
yeah, everything.
The theta component.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is against...
Yeah. It's a closed box, basically, for the magnetic field. We have actually done these things with the different boundary conditions, and you basically get the same results. I mean, it's affected. I mean, I've even tried doing things where you vacuum magnetic field out of the top if it gets there and gets in the way, but you get basically the same results, so it's not much different. So it's a mixed finite difference and pseudospectral codes where it works pretty well, and it's very highly parallelized. So No, this is the standard code for doing this
I'm
stuff for us.
I'm surprised you're getting the same results, because as I remember, midfield dynamos, when they run closed boundary conditions and sort of open, eigenvalue and eigenfunctions are different.
Well, I think if you bear with me while I tell you what I think happens, I think you'll see that it doesn't have much to do with the boundary conditions. And sure, yeah, whether it recycles and interferes
because
with what's going on is a problem, but... Sorry?
Because you're localizing things.
Yeah, because it's localized, right, basically. So this is what we do. What we're going to try and do is build this localized velocity shear and then add some magnetic field to it. So here's a picture of the velocity shear I'm putting in. So Z is downwards. This is the vertical direction of the box. Y is across the box, and X is along the box. So I have a region at the top of this box where there's nothing going on. There's no shear whatsoever. Then I'm going to turn on a forcing function in the equations, which actually forces, in the absence of anything else, it forces this velocity profile. So if there's no magnetic fields, no nothing in this, then this velocity profile, is a solution of the equation. So this thing will this thing will happily sit around there if I don't do anything else to it.
Does it mean it's a kinematic replacement, or you just have to put in a force that will produce this?
I put in a force which will produce this velocity shear. Okay.
So which direction is U?
U is in the X direction.
So Z is up,
okay,
Y is up.
Yeah, Z is down, Y is across, and so it's X, Y, Z, and it's U, V, W in this thing. So the velocity, I put a velocity field in X, which is a function of Y and Z. Okay, so I have a flow this way, which has a cosine dependence this way, and it has some algebraic dependence this way, which turns it on and off. Okay, so you should be able to see that. So as I go down in depth, it turns on and off. And as I go across it this way, it's basically a cosine across in the y direction. But it's a flow u in the x direction.
Are you unstable layer under no shear?
No, this is all unstable. No, sorry, this is all stable. It's all stable layer dynamics. There's no convection on this thing. Convection layer would be above. This is like the Tackett line. So I have some radial shear, and I have some horizontal shear.
But then what causes the turbulence?
There's no turbulence.
Ah, okay.
This is just a shear. It's just a localized shear. It's a shear thing. I mean, there will be turbulence.
Shear, how do you have periodic
boundary? This is just constant in X. So it goes in one side and it comes out the other side. I mean, you can see this is periodic. It's cosine and it has...
Above Z, no, it's whatever it is. It's not like a shearing box.
No, the boundaries are not shearing. It's a forcing function which forces this flow, which just looks like this. So you can see this is periodic in Y.
And X,
yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Stationary wall and
no, there's no walls. This is periodic in the horizontal. Okay, and it has stress-free upper and body bounds. But these are not moving boundaries. This is forced by a forcing function.
What he's saying, you have cosine. That suppose you put nulls at the boundary, when you take derivative over y, you'll get sine, which is not null. So the u over y at the boundary will be not null.
Not what? No?
Zero.
Not zero. Right? The u over dy.
This is periodic. I mean, this is a cosine function. It's periodic in the y direction. I don't see what the problem is.
So there's no boundary, really.
There's no boundary there. It's periodic. I mean, there's lots of these things. There's lots of these things added together. Yeah. I mean, you can think of it as lots of cosines continuing on to infinity.
So I can see how this sort of mimics what you might expect with differential rotation and latitude.
Yeah. This kind of looks like the latitude. I mean, this cosine function sort of looks like the latitude direction, and this function I've chosen in the vertical turns it on and off. Kind of isolates it to the tax plane.
You don't have the equivalent of the radial shear.
Yeah. I do. That's what this function of z is. It comes along and it turns this thing on. So it goes to a certain amplitude, then it turns it off. So it's zero in this bottom bit here, and it's zero up here, but it turns it off.
If you wanted to have it be like what you saw.
Oh, it's not the same as that, no.
Step function or something.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we tried that, and that was hard to do. Yeah, what this one does, in Z, it kind of looks like this. So it turns on and off. Yeah, we did do one where it sort of went like this, but we had problems of interaction with the boundary because, you know, you're putting heat in here like this, and this is a weird place if you do that. So we localized it even more.
So this is a function which gives you a velocity that's constant in time.
No, this is the velocity field you're looking at right here, which in the absence of all other effects, talk amongst yourselves, carry on. Do you want to come and sit down for a while you carry on chatting? No, I'm just kidding. Is everyone's questions answered? Thank
you. This is a good way of specifying the shear, but the essential assumption that it basically makes is that the cause of the shear is also in this box.
Yeah, I'm saying nothing about where the shear comes from. No, that's absolutely arbitrary. I have nothing to say about where the shear comes from. I mean, I know where it comes from with my Coke. They're just sticking in there. But it's an act of Nick. Shear. Okay. Yeah, it's not self-consistent, the generation of the shear.
So can I ask another question about
that? Nope, that's enough. I'm just kidding.
So do you use, if it's done with a force, then rather than specifying the velocity, is that right?
There's a term in the equations. So you have du by dt plus u, well, I mean, this is not compressible, but, you know, it looks like this, equals grad p plus rho g plus something u del squared u plus f.
Okay.
Okay, and I say, well, we'll assume some sort of hydrostatic balance. We'll assume it's time independent. I'll choose a u such that this thing goes to zero.
So f
equals like minus mu del squared of whatever I want it to be, u naught. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay.
That velocity is what you would have without F, without the magnetic field.
Yeah, no magnetic field. So I'm assuming that a lot of stuff. I mean, the Lorentz force here. I'm assuming is the magnetic field off as well. So J cross B is also zero in this thing. Okay.
Yeah, they want to think you have shear on the boundaries.
Sorry.
There's no boundaries.
It's periodic. There's lots of these shears added. They go on for infinity in two directions. Okay, and there's at the top and bottom, there's zero flow at the top and bottom. Is everyone happy with the shear now?
Yeah, go on.
What's going on?
I thought this was quite a good picture of myself, but no. Anyway, okay. So now it's going to get complicated.
So does it?
That was the easy bit.
Does it matter?
No, he's not
reflecting
any. No, I mean the nonlinear. If you take if you calculate nonlinear of this, it's zero. Because this is a function of u and it has no function of x in it. So the nonlinear term is zero. That's not an assumption. It's absolutely zero. Okay. So it's satisfied. So you can see in the absence of magnetic field, this equation is satisfied and that flow just comes out. So if I don't put any magnetic field in, it just stays at that flow forever. Well, assuming it's stable. Okay, and to start with, we're going to be working with flows which are stable. So this is a stable flow. If I don't put any magnetic field in, my calculation will eat up a lot of computer time doing just this. Is everyone with me? Good, okay. Right. And we did that to make sure that it does that, okay? No, never mind. If you have a question, it's easier if you ask me rather than him, you know? All right, so what we do is we take this flow, okay, and we stick in a magnetic field in the y direction, okay? So this is like a poloidal component of magnetic field because it's going across in the y direction. It's going to be very weak, and actually I put it everywhere at some very, very weak level, okay? So it's going across this cosine shear. So it's in the y direction, across this cosine shear.
You should point in this direction.
Well, it's like that direction in this picture here, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, it's that direction.
And
it's hard to do in three dimensions.
Right? The
velocity is in this direction, yeah. And it goes this way.
He wants shear.
It's a shear. All right, maybe this will help. So what do we do? Okay, here's some crappy pictures, I'm afraid, because it's all I had. Now let's go back here. Okay, see this plane? This is where the maximum ZV I have here is where the maximum velocity is. So where cosine is, this thing's at the maximum amplitude. So if I take a plane, an XY plane through that thing, through that point there, and I'm going to look at it right here. So, if I start with U equals zero as my initial condition and then turn on that forcing, gradually it's going to build up the velocity. And you can't see it very well in here, but what I'm doing is, you can see it's building up arrows this way and that way, which is the cosine velocity. So it's going zoop, zoop. Okay? And then I've put in the magnetic field in this direction, across here. So this is the y direction right here. I put in the magnetic field across this thing. Okay?
What's the Reynolds number in this?
I have all kinds of different Reynolds numbers. It has a Reynolds number dependence and has a magnetic Reynolds number dependence. So this is, I'm just trying to give you the typical sort of scenario that happens with these things first, and then I'll tell you the dependence and the Reynolds number. How about that? That satisfy you? Good. All right, so I put in a magnetic field across this shear. And as you can see, well, what do you expect it to do? And if it was frozen in there, they would start grabbing it and pulling it out. And where the velocity shear is the maximum, it's going to pull it out the most, right? So it takes these field lines and goes, which is exactly what you're expecting for these Omega effects. Sorry?
It doesn't make that noise.
It's quite noise. It's compressible. There's a lot of sound associated with this process, okay? So you can see that it starts pulling these things out. And obviously where the shear is the maximum, this is a cosine, it goes, so the shear is maximum here at about a quarter of the way up. And three quarters of the way up, the shear is the maximum. So it's going to condense the magnetic field lines in this. So there's an Omega effect happening here, right? We're taking the poloidal and we're converting it to toroidal, which is exactly like that little picture. I'm doing exactly, where is it? This. Okay, I'm doing exactly this. I'm taking something across it and I'm going, I'm shearing it out and making this. All right. Hopefully everyone's got that. So, well, that was just a horrible picture of it. What does it look like if I look at it in 3D? Well, that's what it looks like. Okay? So what I've done, so now you're looking, this is the y direction across here, that's the x direction. So it's independent of the x direction right now. And I've taken that field, which was in the y direction, and I've sheared it out and I've created a field in the x direction. So I've taken by and converted it into bx. Okay? And it these things look like tubes, right? So we have some sort of dynamics is what
they're
we're...
Not thin.
Thank goodness for that. These are fat tubes. Yeah. And people have done fat tubes before, but these ones have appeared spontaneously, right? I haven't said, I'll just stick one in there. These things have suddenly appeared. Okay. So given this thing, I should say what we're looking at here, actually. This is a volume rendering of B squared. So we're just looking at the amplitude of magnetic field or magnetic energy, whichever you want to look at it. Now,
these are opposite fields.
Yes, so one of these is this way and the other one is that way because it's been sheared here in one and there in the other. So this comes from the induction. So there's a d by dt of bx which looks like dyu times by. So that's a production of this thing from induction.
So
okay.
For the sun, you should think of this.
Yeah, right. That's right. This is the northern hemisphere. This is the southern hemisphere. But this is not the sun. It's not usually this sort of shape. It never has a big A up here in the sun. So
you started with the sun. So just, we know where we stand.
Yes, you know where you stand. You stand well. You sit over there. How about that? So anyway, so we have two tubes formed. They're dominated by this BX field component, of course, and they're opposite polarity, as David pointed out. So what's going to happen to these things? Well, you can already see, here's a plot of the difference between the density and the mean density, okay? So where these tubes have formed, there is actually a density deficit forming right here as well because of this magnetic buoyancy mechanism. So we've made some B squared, so there's a magnetic pressure that's contributing to the total pressure, so the gas pressure has to go down. So if it's isothermal, then the density has to go down. And indeed it does, okay?
What do you think about the energy equation?
Nothing to that.
So it's
perfect. Oh, what was
it?
No. It's P equals rho T.
And it's finite.
Plus, and as the pressure is a total pressure of gas pressure and magnetic pressure.
So what is your energy equation?
No, I'm solving. I mean, in the code, I solve a temperature equation.
Yeah, and you have thermal diffusion.
Yeah, it has thermal diffusion. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the energy equation.
Yeah. So okay. So what would you expect to happen with these? Is magnetic buoyancy going to act? Well, here it is, and it does. So the magnetic these magnetic structures, or tubes, are created by the shear. The density drops due to the contribution from the magnetic pressure. What actually happens is, this is buoyancy acting in a very clear manner. So they're created, the density drops. They start to make, because the density drops here, they just tend to make these little circular flows which go up through the middle and down around the outsides. Those things tend to add vector, this magnetic structure up, and off it goes. So shear creates them. They evacuate the interiors. They create a flow which drives these things up, which is just buoyancy. That's what buoyancy does. And off they go. So here we have it, just what we were looking for. Localized shear creates magnetic structures. The structures look like tubes, and these things rise by magnetic buoyancy. End of story. Maybe I should shut up now. Well, maybe not, because it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. So, there's all kinds of behavior.
They're not twisted when they're unstable, right?
They are twisted.
They are twisted. These things actually can have twists around them, because they're rising through a background BY, so that can add a component, so they can have twisted. So, yeah, I'm just plotting B squared here so you can't see it, but we're going to come to that, don't worry. But the good thing is, one might expect that, so these things rise up, and they're rising, let's go back, that way. So remember the shear, that was pretty good, the shear is only here. So once these things rise out of the shear, there's nothing but diffusion to act on them up here, and they're going to go away. But once these things have gone away, the only term in the equations is this forcing function, which forces the shear, so the shear reappears, if it's gone away at all, which doesn't necessarily go away, but then you're going to come back to shear. There's still some BY in this direction because I didn't let it go out of the box, okay? And then the whole process starts again. So you think, oh, this is great, so I'll do one of these, it'll go away, and then what do I do? I'm back to the start, and it'll do it again, and it'll keep on doing it again and again and again. So this should be a cyclic process, right? And indeed it is. But it's not quite a cyclic process you expect, unfortunately. But you can see here, if I plot bx against time, so bx, just take take bx somewhere on this one and see how it varies with time, then, sure, bx comes up and goes down and comes up and goes down, comes up and goes down. So these things are appearing and emerging, basically, is what this thing is saying. So it creates a strong magnetic field, and then it boots it out. Then it creates a strong magnetic field and boots it out again. So there's a cyclic thing. So cyclic emergency definitely occurs, but it's a little more complicated than the simple scenario I'm just saying here, because it doesn't quite do it in the two perfect roles sense that I had here. The period can vary depending on the parameters. And it's related, it's related to both the magnetic and the regular diffusivity, the viscosity and the magnetic resistivity.
Okay? There's an upper boundary that holds these things in. Does this flux just tend to accumulate in there?
No, not really, because it gets up here and it just diffuses. There's quite a lot of diffusion in this box. It can just diffuse away and that's it. It can recycle it a bit, but there's not much flow going on up here either, so it doesn't really pile up very much. And like I said, we tried it with Hoovers up here, but it didn't make much difference.
Orientation, of course, is the same for each. Right.
Well, that's the thing. This emergence you see here is very, very unusual. So I've got two perfectly symmetrical x-independent things just going zoop up here. And that's very, very difficult because that's a very, very symmetric state. So you can see any noise in this thing is going to destroy this type of thing. So this simple scenario which I've just given to you is not quite what happens. And what really happens is that one of these things dominates and you get this alternating sort of roll pattern. So really that x-symmetric state is very difficult to get, and you get this thing which is not quite symmetric, and I'll show you what the deal with that is. So
it's all numerical noise in your case.
It's numerical noise which will break the symmetry in this thing, sure. I didn't add any noise to this thing, no. So, I'll just show you actually what happens, because then we can talk about why it happens, or exactly how it happens. So here's a movie of this thing just to prove to you that it happens, hopefully.
Any parameters at which the non-alternating tube thing is stable?
Let me get to that in a second, Steve. So, see what happened? It formed tubes. Okay? But these things are sitting there. Note this, because this is going to be an important thing. Oh, now all of a sudden they start doing things and off they go. Whoop, up comes one. And you can see they don't get very far out of the shear before they disappear, before they diffuse. Okay, but it's a cyclic process, right? It's not quite the cycle.
Give the BY
No, BY is just sitting this way.
Okay.
Right. BY stays the same the whole time. Okay, it's just a seed field. I put it in at the start and it doesn't change. But you can see that what happens is that one of these things starts to dominate, and so it generates a flow which suppresses the other one and advances it.
But this is, they don't feed the surface because...
Because they diffuse.
They diffuse.
Yeah, this is a tall. This is a tall box. No, you can see it. It's just, it's there. Yeah, up here, there's nothing happening but diffusion. So you know, when these things get out of here, they're diffusing.
They're gone.
They're gone.
Diffuse.
Well, these are opposite. These are opposite. These are opposite signs. So they just diffuse away the BX, and you get left with the BY. That's it. So you know, one. It's an emergence thing. Okay, so you get these things, and this is what I call alternating tubes or alternating rolls, but this is one. So everyone's got...
Maybe it's 3D, right? But there's no 3D...
No, right now there's nothing in 3D, and we'll come to that shortly. Okay, so let's go back to what we saw earlier, and let's just describe in a little more detail. So one of the things to notice is that when I showed that movie, the first thing it did wasn't just they all started popping up and popping off all over the place. This thing sort of created the tube, and they sat there for a while, which is not quite what you expect. You'd expect these things, as soon as you create magnetic field, they're magnetically buoyant, and they start rising, and off they go. So the interesting thing is that the buoyant rise of these structures, it normally halts within the shear flow region, and that is an equilibrium state. It reaches an equilibrium state. It's not a static equilibrium state because it's a balance of the stretching and creation of this tube, so taking BY and stretching it and making it to BX, and the advection, which is set up by the buoyancy in this thing, and diffusion. So it's a balance of those three things. What that does is allow that tube to just sit there. So it's being stretched, it's being diffused, and it's trying to be, and there's an advective flow. And the balance of those things makes this stable equilibrium. So it's a stable equilibrium, but it's non-static. Okay, is this a... Well, sorry, I didn't mean to say stable. No, it's an equilibrium. I didn't mean to say stable, sorry. Well, it is in certain cases, but anyway. So anyway, the one you just looked at, so here's what was happening. So you start pumping up BX, and then BX gets to a certain level, and it's risen a certain amount, and then it gets to this equilibrium state. So here it is at this equilibrium state, which is reasonably happy for a while. And then an instability sets in, which is this alternating roll thing, joom, 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 and off they go. You know, one creates, and you can see in this plot, this is BX of different signs. So this is the positive sign as a solid, and the negative sign is a dotted. So first of all, it sends off the positive one, then the negative one, positive one, negative one, positive one, negative one.
So you put B at certain spatial point.
Yeah, that's what this is. No, this is actually plotting the maximum of B or something like that, whatever the maximum of the absolute value of B is. Okay? So, the thing is, what do I want to say? Oh, I guess I should read what I wrote. That would help. So the way this instability works is that we have this equilibrium, and one of the structures becomes dominant for some reason, for noise or whatever, and the flow that it sets up through its tube, so up in the middle, down on the outside, the down on the outside is holding the other one down, okay? And because this one is stronger, this one, it's holding that one down more than the other one, than it is holding the other one down. So then that one sort of starts to dominate, it grows, that one rises. Once it's gone, this one is the dominant one. Then off we go. We can go around the cycle.
We can define the equilibrium state with this part flat.
What defines it?
What process stops the gross field and makes it flat?
Didn't I just talk about that? Here, magnetic buoyancy rises normally halts when the shear flow region, due to a balance between the shear production, which is this term, you take BY and you've got a shear and you generate it, so the shear production of BX from BY, advection, so there's this. Because you set up magnetic buoyancy, you've got these little roll circulations which are trying to drive it up, and diffusion. There's a balance of all those three terms, which means that it can sit there ad nauseum.
What about Lorentz force?
No, Lorentz force does not balance this thing. Well, Lorentz force.
That's the main point in the first place, right?
I guess there is an adjustment. Yeah. Oh, sorry. That's exactly what I'm going to next. So let me go on. So the thing is, okay. No.
There's that other question I asked before.
What was your question before?
Well, any problems about this which you can't get alternating?
You can get this. You can make that equilibrium stable. You can make it just sit there. I can show you a mover of it. It's really boring.
Up together.
That's very, very difficult to do, and usually I can only get that to occur if I start an equation, sorry, equation, if I start a simulation from the shear flow already imposed, and then I bung the magnetic field in, then that's the first thing that happens, and then it goes into this long transient where everything is a mess. Then it settles down to this, is usually what happens. It's very hard to make those... like a Knorr block, yes. yes, I guess there is, sure.
I don't quite buy this point that you can, if you have a shear which increase your B, mm-hmm. and then diffusion starts work, mm-hmm. diffusion will sort of kill and diffuse the B. It might take you a little bit sort of equilibrium, and then the curve is supposed to go down, but you stay for hundreds of times.
Yeah, yeah, it could last forever. I mean, you can imagine.
Something else.
I have two terms. I have one which is a production and one which is a diffusion, right? I mean, I can balance those two terms, right? And it turns out there's a little bit of the other one, but I can balance those two terms, right?
If you solve the equations, it goes into
But I mean, maybe what you really want to ask is what happens if the magnetic Reynolds number goes to infinity? I mean, does this thing become increasingly more unstable,
right.
which you would get to if we...
it's very small magnetic Reynolds number. Then I'm back.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's not super small, but I mean, it doesn't matter. But we'll talk about...
X on the ordinate is Bx squared.
Sorry? This is the thing, I can't remember exactly what I plotted, but I think it's the maximum of Bx over the box.
One fixed level, or it's the...
It's the maximum of Bx over the box.
At any given time.
I mean, that will give you this plot. I don't remember whether this is exactly that one, but that's what it will give you. Okay.
So it follows the emergence.
Yeah, so I mean that's it. So it tells you where, you know, what is going on with Bx basically. So anyway, as Steve alluded to, this thing is a little bit more complicated than even I've already said, because you can actually, I mean, this thing looks like a, you know, this thing looks like a linear stability of this non-static state. Okay, so you can actually make this a linear instability, or you can examine a linear instability. And basically, the way it works is like this. So at some stage, someplace, I've got shear. So I'm just saying, let's take a linear state. If I actually wanted to make this a linear instability, let's do it this way. So I've got some shear. So I've got some velocity profile, which is, you know, sheared like this. Then I add a perturbation to it. Vroom, vroom. So I decrease it a little bit here and increase it a little bit over there. What that's going to do, if I put magnetic field into this thing, is that I'm going to create stronger magnetic field here where the shear is steeper, and stronger magnetic field here where the shear is steeper, and create less magnetic field here where the shear is flatter. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So what that means is that I'm going to evacuate things because of this magnetic buoyancy effect. Where the magnetic field is stronger, I'm going to make the density lower. So I'm going to make the density lower over here, density lower over here, and the density, well, whatever it wants to be in the middle. And what that's going to do is drive a secondary flow which says, okay, where the density is higher, density lower, I'm going to try and drive a V this way. And what this V can do is amplify steepen the shear. Does that make sense to everybody? Because I've taken this thing, I put a little perturbation on it, what it's tend to do is going to push it this way and try and pile everything up this way. Okay? Is everyone with me? So that's what Steve was asking. This is basically a Lorentz adaptation acting back on the velocity. So in my induction, I mean, the balance I gave you, the diffusion, advection, production balance, assumes that U has not been affected, but U has been affected in this manner. It feeds back on the mean shear. So this is an instability. You can see that as soon as I put a little perturbation on this, it's going to increase the perturbation, and it's an instability, okay? All right, so some of your questions are, what happens if we change the parameters? So this one, go back. Ooh, there was your twist. Insight. Where's my cursor? There it is. Let's see if this thing goes. So this is higher magnetic Reynolds number. And basically what we do is have the same process, except now I'm putting off tubes of, it's more chaotic, the sign of which one is going up at any one time. And it's more chaotic, the intervals between them. So it doesn't look, it's not nice and regular. So I guess that's kind of what you would expect to have.
What does it mean, higher? What's the numbers?
Well, you know what? I didn't put specific numbers in here because there's huge parameter regions where you can get these things. So if I told you the Reynolds number, then I'd have to tell you all the other parameters as well. So the Prandtl number, the this, the blah, blah, blah. So assume that, you know, I've chosen a set of parameters and I've increased the Reynolds number of this one, the magnetic Reynolds of this one from the previous one. And I've got the paper. I can show you the actual numbers if you really want to know. I mean, for this set of parameters. Sorry?
The number of mesh points is maybe.
This is only like 64 cubed or something like this. It's not huge. I mean, the Reynolds number based on is like, where is it? Well, for the previous one, it was 289. This one is 579 or something like that. But it's based on the scale of the box, so it sounds bigger than it really is. Because this is, I mean, if I based it on this scale, it would actually be a lot smaller. Okay? So, but still note, as somebody asked, anyway, everything is invariant in the x direction. We haven't had any... Everything is x invariant so far. So, it's 1/1/3 or something like that.
Okay.
But it's 1/1 in this one. Yeah, it's the two horizontal directions are the same. I can't remember what it was in verb. Actually, it might even be 1/1/1. I can't remember. No, it must be bigger than that. Anyway. So, well, let's change the parameters a little bit more. So we'll take that Rm and we'll increase Re. So now basically what I'm doing is increasing the speed of the shear flow a little bit, or allowing less viscosity in this thing to act, okay? Reducing the viscosity. Keeping everything else the same, I've reduced the viscosity. That's probably the best way to think of it, okay? So now what we see is that now what we'll find, well, okay, so let's go through what happens with our low Re. So at low Re, I have this equilibrium, and it'll just sit there forever, okay? If I go to moderate Reynolds number, I'll get that instability to alternating tubes, which you just saw. Why does he ask him the question? I don't get it. Anyway, so for higher Reynolds number, we get the secondary instability, which breaks the x invariance. So here's the x direction. Now I get this kinked tube. So I get this helical kink. So let me show a movie of this so you guys get some idea of what's going on. Well, go back. Oh, why is it doing that? Go back. There we go. All right. So now, same sort of thing, just a little bit lower viscosity than we saw before. Okay? Wow, doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself? Now it's in equilibrium. It sits around for a while. There it starts going. Yeah, you see that? I bashed it. But now notice what happens to. Oh, there we go. See, you can see how it kind of kinks at the top? Zoop. See how it kinks? Zoop. Well, it doesn't do it so much towards the end of the movie, but does it more in the middle. Okay, but you see there's a twist involved in this thing now. So it's like it was before, but now it's getting kinked as it goes up, you
and
think.
That's driven by the twist in the field?
Just wait. I got the slides about the whole thing. Okay. So it looks like, so there's times when the field looks like this. Everyone agree with me? My God, what a miracle. Oops, wrong way. All right, so what is this? This helical kink is nothing to do with magnetic kinks. Am I saying this just for you? This is nothing to do with magnets. It's not a magnetic kink instability. This is a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability of the shear flow which is going on. Because remember what we do is we take this thing. Well, the original shear flow I start with is stable to Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. But I've thrown this magnetic field in there. And what we've already seen is this magnetic field induces flows which can steepen the shear, the original shear. So I get into a certain regime, you know, low enough viscosity, I'm steepening that shear. That steeper shear is Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable. Okay, so I've taken a Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable thing. Because I have the magnetic buoyancy, this thing becomes, you know, steeper shear and it goes Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable. And it goes Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable in both directions, vertical and y direction. So it has this 2D Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which is this winding kink. So that thing is not a magnetic kink instability. It's a flow which is generated by a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which winds up the magnetic field.
What's the Richardson number? You know?
Oh, Jesus, I have no idea. What's the definition of the range? The delta.
I'm just wondering if it's a shear in the x direction instability.
It's both.
So it can overcome the.
It's 2D. I mean, it has...
You could set off in one direction and that set everything off in the other direction, or it could.
It could do, yeah. But I mean, the fact that this thing kinks, I mean, it wouldn't kink it if it wasn't a 3D mode.
So you could...
Or it wasn't a 2D instability mode.
You imagine a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability if you didn't have any Z components.
Right.
And that was called a Kelvin-Helmholtz.
Yeah, then it would just wiggle the tube like this.
Sorry?
Then it would just wiggle the tube like this, right? Yeah. Well, there's an interaction of all the flows. But I mean, if you look at the perturbations to this thing, you see something which, you know, you have a V perturbation, which looks like a sine, and you have a W perturbation as well, which looks like a cos. And they're a little bit displaced and a little bit out of phase. So this is what gives you this helical kink. Okay? So...
And could it be it's either handedness then? Is there any preference as to what the phase is? If they're just out of phase.
No, it has to... It has to go one way. It always goes the same way, yeah. So it has to go one way. But, I mean, the thing, and I'll show you in a minute, it can flip and go back the other way. And we'll come to that in a second, okay? But this thing, anyway, just to say something, this is I know this for absolutely sure, because this is a Kelvin-Helmholtz, not magnetic kink instability, because I can turn off the Lorentz forces and this thing still happens. Okay, you can't turn off the magnetic buoyancy, because you need the buoyancy to drive these flows, which gives you the thing. So it's an MHD secondary instability, this thing. But it's a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, so it's hydrodynamic, but it's instigated by magnetic field. Wow.
You mean turn off the Lorentz force?
Yeah.
Tension.
Sorry, I didn't mean Lorentz force. Yes, tension. Turn off the magnetic tension, leave the magnetic buoyancy. I misspoke. So, your other question, Mr. Tobias, Dr. Tobias, Professor Tobias, was what's the aspect ratio of the box? So here's one. You know, you can get other stuff. So here's one where I say, okay, I'm going to make the x direction very long compared to the y direction. Then I can get instabilities to this thing, to this sort of shape. So these are arches. So let's have a look at this baby happen. It's going to be some weird stuff happening over here, don't worry. Oh, once again, non-static equilibrium. Here's the shimmy. Off it goes. Zoom. Starts sending off things like arches. Then it goes to an awful mess because it's disrupted the shear a lot. But, you know, there are, you know, it does this sort of thing. Where people says, is this the Parker instability? Well, no, it's not the Parker instability, because this thing is an instability off this non-static equilibrium, which has nothing to do with what Parker did. But it does have this sort of arching sort of profile. So other things are available. So now we have this thing which does a lot of the stuff that we want. First of all, we start with a localized shear and a weak poloidal field. It gives us toroidal field. It gives us toroidal field, which looks like tubes. Tubes rise due to magnetic buoyancy. And they give some sort of morphology, evolution, and geometries, which look like the sort of things we want. We can get kink things, and we can get arch things. Okay, so we're in pretty good shape right now. We're quite happy with what's happened. One of the first people say at this stage is, well, isn't all this very, very dependent on the type of shear you've chosen, because it doesn't look anything like the damn tachycline? Well, the answer is no, because we've done some other calculations. Instead of using a cosine in the y direction, you choose something which looks almost like a square wave, or you look something that almost looks like a sawtooth. By sawtooth, I mean something which looks like this. Okay, so it has a very strong shear in the middle and weaker shear on the outside. It's still another periodic thing. And I'll talk about these things any second now, because this is an attempt to create a thing which has one tube rather than two tubes, so they don't interact. Okay. So everyone happy so far? I guess that's the end of my talk, but I have another bit to talk about if people have a moment.
Is that Kelvin-Helmholtz label then?
Yes. Well, no. This one will specifically use to be non-Kelvin-Helmholtz stable. I mean, you could make it stable depending on what you chose for the Fram.
You mean you're not going to talk about the dynamo?
I mean, it's 3:30, so I mean, I'd like to talk about some more stuff if people 4:30. Have 4:30. Okay, I'm on Colorado. No, I'm the wrong one. All right. I'll do it fast. How about that? And we'll see what happens.
Oh, fast.
Or I'll go even slow. So.
Can you open the door?
So that people can leave and run? Also, people can sprint out now?
No, oxygen.
All right. So this helical kink instability that Kelvin-Helmholtz generated is a fun thing, right? But it's also fairly interesting because that twist of the magnetic field creates a poloidal magnetic field, right? So I started off with field this way, and I went, zoop, made it this way. So now I have this kind of loop in the YZ direction, which is poloidal for me. Okay, toroidal is along X, so I have a poloidal. So you could call this thing, in quotes as always, an alpha effect, because what I'm doing is taking toroidal field and turning it into poloidal field. So notice that this is an alpha effect. It has absolutely nothing to do with rotation. Okay, rotation is not involved in this problem. Sorry?
Does it have handedness?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yes, it does have a handedness, and that's exactly what we're going to see here. So now what we're going to do... Well, so let's follow this following experiment, what we're going to do. What we're going to do with this is now, since we have an omega effect, which creates toroidal from poloidal, and now we have this thing, which creates poloidal from toroidal, you think, let's build a damn dynamo out of this thing. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to use a slightly different configuration than one we just used, which is to use this sawtooth profile, like I just mentioned. So the idea of this is just to try and get one nice tube in the middle here, rather than two tubes, so they don't interact, okay? And that's what I'm going to do. And what I'm going to do is change the BY field so that it's all positive in the top half and all negative in the other half. And this is the handedness that I have to start with, and this is what sets the handedness of the initial tube. So I've said right in the top, left in the bottom. Obviously, I could switch that around, and this thing would still work. So that's what gives me a handedness to this particular case. Okay?
You know, he shouldn't call it.
I know. It's not. So that's why I keep putting it in quotes.
Why he keeps calling it.
It's only an alpha.
It's not an alpha.
I said that in the beginning. I loosely used that term to mean something which creates toroidal field into poloidal field, converts. That's my use of it.
We expand the paper because otherwise we're going to get into all sorts of trouble.
All right. So that's what happens. Okay. So this is the thing. So, what the heck happens with this one? Well, look at this thing. For a weak initial field. So if I give this thing a really weak initial field, this BY this time, I mean, if nothing happens, this thing's just going to diffuse, right? Because this is this way here, diffusion is going to eradicate it. And sure enough, that's what happens. So if you look at the maximum of BX, or you look at this thing, boom, magnetic energy just decays. So for a weak initial field, this thing decays, as it should do. And this gives you some idea of the resistive decay time as well. It's 300. I mean, E-folding time is about 300 or something like that. For a moderate initial field, this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability of the flow is going to happen. And you're going to shear things out, they're going to rise, and they're going to kink. Okay? So Kelvin-Helmholtz instability kinks the flow. Kink flows produce a poloidal field around the emerging structures. And a few of these events are going to happen. And then when this poloidal field gradually builds up enough, it's going to reverse my initial field. So initially I had it this way. This tube tries to make it the other way, and eventually it's going to reverse it. Okay, I'll describe this in great gory detail in a moment. But the thing to notice here is look what happens. This is a plot of the same sort of thing, maximum BX and minus the minimum of BX. So, you know, the maximum of the absolute.
Are you trying to convince us that the dynamo depends on the initial field?
The saturation level, there's some minimum level of magnetic field you have to kick this thing off. And then I'm going to show you that it depends on other parameters. Okay. If I have too weak an initial field, it won't go at all.
Does it depend on the form of the initial
field? Well, yes. In this case, it does. It has to be this way and that way. If I drew it all this way, this dynamo wouldn't happen. Okay. Because I have to. And if you watch the mechanism, I think. Well, maybe I'll just jump to. Maybe I'll just jump. Well, let me show you this. I don't remember what this movie is, but let's see what it does. So, I mean, this is actually what's going on in this thing, I think. Why isn't it going?
This is the non-dynamo case.
No, this is the, yeah. Why didn't it start? Well, there we go. Okay, so we're doing one tube in the middle here, okay? So this looks a little different. So we have two fatter tubes on the outside, and it's putting up one in. And you can see that it's twisting and kinking. So that's the process which is happening, okay? It's like the one we saw before, but there's only one of them. And if you look along here, you can see this is what's happening. It's sending up these things of one polarity, and then it's going to switch and it's going to send up the things of the other polarity, and that's what produces this cyclic dynamo. The thing is, I started off with a very weak field, and this is keeping something of a...
How do you know this dynamo, it will not die after you finish?
Well, look, I mean, I just said a resistive time was 300. Look, this goes to 2500. I mean, it's not absolutely sure that it's not a dynamo, but it's doing pretty good.
If your box were infinitely long along the tube, would you still get a mean field?
Would I still get a mean field?
I mean, if it develops several such kinks, wouldn't they be just random orientations?
No, I mean, the kinks, I mean, they'll all be in the same direction. It'll make it better, if anything.
Same direction.
Yeah, it'll make it better. I mean, look here, good, it stopped at a convenient place. You can see there's one kink in this one, and it's this direction. But this is periodic, so there's an infinite number of these kinks all in the same direction. Okay?
The initial Y field has a net flux in that direction, right?
No, it has zero net flux. It's all this way at the top and all that way at the bottom.
It's changed configuration.
I've changed configuration. Okay. So here explains a lot better what's going to happen. So here's an event. I'm going to show you a bunch of events. Okay. So this is one of these tubes rising and kinking. You're seeing a 2D cut through BX. Okay. Here's BX BZ field rather. So this shows you basically the poloidal component of what's going on in this kink. Right? So I started off with all field this way, all field that way. The tube that it creates automatically, because of that field, opposes that. Okay? So it tries to produce top of the field this top of the tube this way, bottom of the tube that way, which is opposing the original field. Okay, can you see that, George? So let me just go through a sequence of these things. Ooh. So you can all look at it. So here's another event. Still doing the same thing. You can see that by putting this poloidal field against it, it's starting to reduce what's at the top and the bottom. Okay? Trying to turn it around. Oops, which way did I go? Two, three. Here's the next one. Now look what it's done. It's reversed it. So now here's the kinked tube. Now it's made the field at the top go this way and at the bottom this way. So I've reversed the original poloidal field, okay? So now what happens? There it is, it goes again. And now, because I've reversed that background field, now the tubes which kinked are now kinked the other way. So now they're black. They were white before, now they're black. Okay, so BX is the other direction, and the kink goes the other way. So here's the kink going the other way. So now, once again, it's going to try and act against the background field which I originally imposed. You know, and off it goes again. There it goes.
It doesn't mean in this case it's an alternated dynamo, in the other case it's just steady dynamo.
This is a series of events which maintains a strong magnetic field, which is much stronger than the initial magnetic field, but it's a series of intermittent events which cycles and polarity reverses. Okay, it's a dynamo in the sense, well, let's get, I got that slide. So, I mean, does everyone get this concept that it's going to, you know, this thing always opposes whatever field I gave it originally, and so it tries to reverse it after a while. After a number of events, it can reverse it.
Can I just clarify then, it has a right-handed twist to the magnetic field, and then a left-handed twist, and then a right-handed twist?
Okay, let's go back to, wrong way. Let's go back to here. Okay, so this one, you can see.
Yeah.
It does right-handed, 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 and it's building up its opposition to the original field, and eventually it makes it strong enough, and it goes, ah, you suck, background field, reverses the background field. Then it goes, whoops, I'm in the opposite configuration. So now it kinks left-handed, 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 left-handed.
I guess I can't see that from that plot. That
no, it's the dotted ones, yeah. It says that its BX is negative.
Right.
So to start off with, it's producing tubes this way, this way, this way, this way,
right,
until it reverses the background field. So then when it grabs it and makes a field, it's like, whoops, I've grabbed it. Now this way, this way, this way, this way.
The screw sense.
Right, and then the screw sense, you know, the Kelvin-Helmholtz thing is always... the Kelvin-Helmholtz is always the same sign, but if I'm this way and this sign and this way, and this sign is the opposite.
I think it always ends up being
the same. Yeah, I don't know about that.
You must conserve something. Yeah,
it has nothing to do with conservation. It's just, you know, you can trace a corkscrew in either direction and it goes.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So once you create a different way, it's a
calculation of that first bunch of seconds.
The only difference is that I chose this shear to try and get one tube rather than two tubes. So, but before,
okay,
before I had a cosine, right, like this.
Right.
So now I just chose this thing because I wanted to get one tube rather than, I didn't want two tubes interfering, so I just wanted one.
Yeah, okay, then there's something about the other.
Okay, then the other thing is that, oh, jeez. It's the exploding eraser.
No field going across
that. No, the other thing is, if I look at the field that I put, okay, this is a Y, Z plane of the field. The original one, what I did was put field looks like this. Okay? This one, what I did was put field that looked like this. Divided down the middle.
Initially.
The strongest sense of shear is, say,
Actually, the strongest sense of shear is somewhere down here. Yeah.
Right,
so these things rise up a bit and then twist and it opposes this field.
Okay, and where's the shear sitting on top of that?
The shear is in here, in this region down here somewhere. It's not right in the middle, it's a little bit lower.
Oh, it's offset.
Yeah, because these things create a tube, then they rise a bit and then they twist. So I want it to twist kind of where the junction is. So, yeah, I set it down a little bit. So yeah, it's a hugely contrived situation. But
yeah, so did we ever establish there's a screw sense of this thing?
I'm not sure. I'll have to look at that. I mean, I don't know offhand whether it's the same.
Mark was just pointing out something about your argument about the Lorentz force. You get rid of the tension, you actually increase the sense of the kink and stability. It's driven by the magnetic pressure of the azimuthal component. The field of tension actually
Yeah, it's true. There is an opposing pile of tension, yeah. I mean, this tension was...
So the point is, you can't really say that...
You turn off the tension, then, and it's still kinked. That's not saying it's not contributing to the delay.
Yeah, that makes it kinked. So kink,
the tension stabilizes. It makes stability.
Yeah, but okay, but I can look at it. I mean, okay.
At the beginning, when the field is all in the same direction, these things have magnetic shear, but I mean, they're not helical in the obvious way. I mean, if you think about them, they have a field along that way, and the top is sheared this way, and the bottom is still sheared that way. It's not, there isn't a real helix going through them. It's a funny thing that sort of goes move like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, is that...
Yeah, the mean direction is still from left to right. It never reverses in the initial one that kinks. Is it right?
Did anything happen with the shear of the flow?
Yeah, the shear.
Did it reduce?
The shear, I mean, yeah, this stuff interacts with the shear. I mean, the instability is created by an interaction, by an effect on the background shear. Right, the steepening of the shear, then you get a Kelvin-Helmholtz sensibility of that shear. So the shear is definitely interacted with,
the
yeah.
Shear,
but think about it, you know, when these things rise and you get rid of these things, then the forcing function tries to force the shear back to what it was before. So there's always trying to be returned to the original shear when the magnetic field's not around.
So it's the shear that's causing the instability.
Oh, yeah.
But as a result, the shear gets amplified?
No, I mean, the shear gets affected. I mean, it gets adjusted. I don't know what you want to call it.
Coming from the shear.
The shear is the driving force for this thing, yes.
So shouldn't in saturation or whatever, when you look at the shear in saturation, it decreases a little bit?
Well, the shear varies over the cycle, but I mean, it gets reduced, it gets increased. I mean, but it'll return to what it was before. Because there's nothing, I mean, the driving forcing just has, you know, wants to drive a particular shear. There's nothing else going on, no magnetic field around it, it'll return it to that shear. So yeah, I mean, it changes, it gets adjusted, but it'll return to whatever it was before. Okay, so I better wrap up. So I mean, the interesting thing is this configuration is a dynamo in the sense that magnetic energy is of significant magnitude is maintained indefinitely. Well, indefinitely is okay, up to 8 resistive times, but that's pretty good. Most people don't do their dynamo calculations up to 8 resistive times. So the ratio of kinetic energy to magnetic energy is 5 to 10, so there's 20% in the magnetic energy, which is not so bad. And the saturated RMS magnetic field is a lot bigger than the original field that I put in. So it's a dynamo in that sense, but it's a weird dynamo because it's a collection of these intermittent events. So it involves both alpha and omega, sorry, the horrible use of the words, type mechanisms, but it's a fully nonlinear thing. This is nothing to do with mean field dynamos. That's why I put that in there to keep Fausto happy. And physically, it's more like a stretch, twist, fold, right? I mean, you take this thing, you twist it, and then you fold it all back on itself, and you start again. Okay, so it's at least. Sure, yeah. I mean, so thank goodness for Milfield giving us the right ideas.
There is no averaging.
Yeah, there's no averaging on this thing.
Well, wait a minute.
It's fully nonlinear, isn't it?
Large scale field. That's your. There's
only large scale field.
That's the
thing.
You haven't shown us the large scale.
That's your box. Your scale.
Have you shown us the average field? Then if you get
the average field of what? Which average field do you want?
Then you cannot give us a hard time. For example,
I mean, you've seen the average. You've seen the large scale BX.
Average over the meridional plane. I think that would be the.
Ooh, meridional. Which direction is meridional?
Meridional.
Well, I mean, you're seeing BX, the average of BX, and those on all these plots.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what you're seeing, and that's what all these are. That's what all these things are. That's what all these things are. I mean, these are average of BX, you know?
I do.
And there it is.
Is that average?
Yeah, this is the average over the box of the BX.
This is a pretty good example in case we're small scale. This mean field formalism is pretty irrelevant.
Yeah, well, no, but it's interesting because this thing, I mean, you get this intuitive concept of how dynamos may operate, this alpha-omega idea, okay? And the interesting thing about this calculation is that this is a fully nonlinear thing. The only thing we did was turn on a shear and throw in some magnetic field, okay? Now, we did it of a particular variety, but it's fairly robust, this mechanism, as you can see. I mean, it's... Like I said, now you can probably tell it doesn't depend that much on boundary conditions. It's nothing to do with boundary conditions. It's robust. But, you know, and it does all the things that these alpha, omega sort of type ideas tell you. But it's fully nonlinear. It's a solution of the MHD equation. It's not.
The mean field dynamo also has what? Solution when alpha is pure nonlinear. This is not new.
This thing as a mean field dynamo, if you want. I mean, we just thought it would not be a very useful thing to do. That was it.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a linguistic problem, but nonlinear, creating alpha nonlinear, it's an old idea, started from Uriel Frisch and so on.
Exactly.
In that sense, I wonder if it's the same or not, again, check. But
hang on, if it were me, I wouldn't even have called it alpha, I would have called it nothing. I just said, this is a dynamo,
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I say alpha omega is to relate it to things that people are used to thinking about. So people are used to thinking about something which creates poloidal field out of toroidal field and calling it, this is an alpha effect or an alpha mechanism.
No. It's an alpha effect. It's like an average over small interactions.
Okay.
Well, how about...
All right. To be technically accurate, this has nothing to do with alpha or omega.
How about these various shallow water instabilities that also have some, I guess they're
Kelvin Helmholtz driven with some handedness, Gilman.
Dick Patty, and yeah.
Is this at all related to that? No. I mean, it should be said that when we started this, it was just to look at this bit. We just wanted to study magnetic buoyancy. We never even thought that this thing would ever turn into a dynamo. And
no, it's just
so, you know, we went about the business, and then one day somebody said, oh, you know, this thing is kinking. What happens if you turn off the main field? And we did, and, you know, thinking, it dies. That's what it does. It dies. You turn off the mean field, it dies on you. So we did, and it didn't. But at this point, it's like the Cantor border dynamo is being done for the sake of doing it. It's not
any use
to the solar dynamo. It's just
no, not at all. But it doesn't involve rotation. This is one of the fun things. No, it doesn't involve any rotation at all.
There's no rotation, no helicity, no nothing.
The handedness, then, it baffles me. I can't understand where it's developed.
Yeah, I mean, there is a handedness depending on. No, but there is a handedness here, depending on which way I start it, right? It's right and left. And I could have done it the other way around, and you would have got it the other way around, right? It would have been different. But I start it with a handedness, so this has this. So this means that the tubes first go this way. So they kink this way the first time I do this.
Well, you have to add a component of the magnetic field into or out of the page. I guess, right.
But I mean that's the thing.
Which way that goes.
So the direction of the shear. Because I have one which looks like this, and I could have done it looking like this. So there's a handedness to the way I've done the shear, and there's a handedness to the way I've done that, which gives you the 3D direction, gives you the kink direction.
So what happens if you change the sign of your magnetic shear?
In the Y field, you mean? If you do the Y field, if I do it this way, so to the right at the top, to the left at the bottom, then the first tube, because of the shear I've chosen, the first tube I do will oppose this. It'll go like this.
Yeah.
Okay? So if I reversed them, the first tube I would get would go the other way.
Yeah, but what happens later?
Then I'll just cycle. It'll just start off and just goes backwards and forwards, but it started the other way around. Okay. Sorry?
This is the vertical direction.
This is the vertical direction, yeah. So, anyway. There it is. You want a good